You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Brian for the past couple of hours, but now it's time to celebrate the light and the dark with Bums on Seats, the fortnightly look at the films now screening at cinemas in and around Cambridge. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the air today are reviewer Simon West.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Morning.
Mark Livesich.
Yo.
And new reviewer Faye Gentile.
Hi.
Today's show seems to be mainly about the pride and foolishness of men, as we feature four new releases fueled by alpha male testosterone. Fast and the Furious 7 finds Vin Diesel leading his ragtag team of road racers as they hunt Jason Statham's vengeful villain. After the dizzy confection of Francis Ha, writer-director Noah Baumbach puts Ben Stiller in a small hat for While We're Young, a look at the clashes between Generation X and Y. Keanu Reeves unleashes an entire arsenal of overreaction when his pet dog is killed by Russian mobsters in the balletically violent John Wick, and a moment of cowardice is the detonation which cracks open a whole marriage in Cannes' winning drama Force Majeure. Plus, as a preview of the upcoming chance to see a number of her films at the Arts Picture House, we'll be talking to Maheli Modi, founder of Second Run DVD, and about Czech director Vera Hetilova. So that's all to come, but first we've got to mirror, signal, manoeuvre.
All right, let's get to work.
Hey, Roman, you freaking out?
No.
Yes, you are.
Should somebody just walk me through what we're supposed to be doing?
Just when you didn't think it could get any better, huh?
Here we go.
Dominic Toretto, you don't know me. You're about to.
Looks like the sins of London have followed us home.
Remember Owen Shaw? This is his big bad brother.
We're being hunted. One last ride.
Get low when the whistle go.
Now we talk. Daddy's gotta go to work.
The Fast and the Furious franchise is one of the wonders of the modern world. The original road race movies was cobbled together from parts borrowed from other films, but it's now risen to the blockbuster stratosphere on the back of an unusually diverse cast and an increasingly preposterous notion of both family and physics. New released Fast and the Furious 7 escalates the series into James Bond absurdity. Led once again by Vin Diesel as the volcanic Dom Toretto, Furious 7 kicks into gear not long after the finale of film 6. Responsible for putting criminal Owen Shaw in a coma, the team find themselves hunted by Shaw's brother Deckard, played by Jason Statham as a man who will destroy a hospital simply to deliver flowers. So Toretto, along with fellow racers Tyrese Gibson, Michelle Rodriguez and the late Paul Walker, embark on a global mission, helped by Kurt Russell's shadowy government agency, to catch up with Deckard before he catches up with them. Simon, to begin with you, Fast and the Furious 7... it's a film that's had its odds stacked against it. It's seven films in a franchise. No franchise makes it the seven unless you're Harry Potter. It has a new director in James Wan. And I know, or a Police Academy or other franchises. Like, so you roll your eyes and thinking of other seven film franchises. And unfortunately, halfway through the production, obviously, there was the death of Paul Walker. Have they managed this unsurmountable obstacles? Does the seventh film still, you know, provide some thrills?
It provides lots of thrills, lots of action, lots of fast cars, just
pretty much what you expect from this franchise. I've been going on a theory for a while that it's only the odd numbers in the Fast and Furious films that are actually worthwhile, and I was quite disappointed with 6 after the relaunch of 5 in the new IMF Mission Impossible style international adventures. And this one is back. The only complaint is probably not enough Jason Statham and not enough The Rock. But whenever they are on screen, you just knew it's just gung-ho, testosterone-filled action. The action sequences are over the top. It's silly. It doesn't take itself seriously. It knows when it goes too far. And that is, you know, what it's good for. I think in 6 and 4, in previous films, they try and take it all too seriously. And they try and be serious with the action. But in this one, like, they forget about it, and that's what works. And I think this one was actually back on form.
Mark, it's as Simon said there, it doesn't take itself too seriously. I can't think of many films that actually do take themselves too seriously now. That's the mantra of this generation's at the pictures. This was never a particularly authentic franchise, even from the 2001 debut, but it was sort of cheap and dirty and B-movie-ish. Has it kept that sort of grit, or now is it all just CGI shine?
I'm not entirely sure what it is anymore. It's gone through so many evolutions, it's difficult to really try and trace the seed of anything that's left in it. It is entertaining. I think the difficulty that it has is trying to maintain some sense of tension, and in particular the fact that it's started to kill off characters. There was one killed off in 6, and one killed off in 3, who then got killed off again in 6 because they're trying to sort out the ridiculous continuity of prequels and sequels that this sort of messy sequence has created. So actually it is a world in which people can die, in which there is a sense of jeopardy, but then you come to the action sequences, which have no sense of reality in physics whatsoever. I defy anyone to show that you could actually climb out the bottom window of a bus and run over the top of it and catch a car as it sweeps past at 60 miles an hour, and that's not a spoiler because it's in the trailer. But, you know, that complete absence of reality, trying to balance that with a feeling of that actually these characters have some sense of danger to go through, it's a difficult balance. I don't think it quite captures that. What you're left with probably most is the moments of sheer exuberance and fun, which are scattered probably throughout the first two-thirds of the film. And then you get to maybe the last third, which is a sort of constant action sequence, and that probably for me worked the best of the film because it is just constant action, and it's probably the best shot, and that's damning with faint praise, of the action sequences. I think it gives the fans what they want. I don't know it gives anyone more than that.
I think that's the positive side of it. It actually embraces the absurdity of those action scenes now, where before it was the over-the-top action and stunts, but they tried to, you know, portray it as real, you know, even so slightly exaggerated. But here, the fact that they don't take those stunts seriously is how it works.
But isn't the joy of a car movie? The race of actual genuine cars, the feeling of speed and tumbling cars and crashes. I didn't get any of that from this film. I know there's real cars in it, but it always felt like it was a comic book movie. I've got comic book movies coming out of my ears. I wanted something a little bit more sort of hard-edged here. Dave, is it the fact that it's devolved into a comic book movie a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing because, as you pointed out earlier, it does suit the audience that's starting to appear now. You're right, we've got comic movies coming out of our ears at the moment. I mean, I'm not entirely unhappy about that. I'll just wait for the next one and watch it gleefully. But when I go to see a Fast and Furious movie, you're right, I want to go and see it for the cars and the amazing car stunts. I know Mark just mentioned the CGI. I did a little bit of background stuff, and quite a few of the stunts weren't as CGI as you thought. They really threw those cars out of the plane and parachuted them with the proper kit that they were describing. I mean, that was amazing enough that you.
Yeah, but then they have a scene like the one in Abu Dhabi or Dubai, wherever they are, when they go to the Middle East, where they're jumping a car from skyscraper to skyscraper, which would look ridiculous in a James Bond film and can only be done through CGI. And
there were two reasons they had to go and mock up a lot of that, and another reason was Paul Walker was no longer there to film that scene. If you'd watch carefully, you'll see there's bits where both of them are meant to be in the car, you can only see one person. It's all, that area is kind of muddled, and I think you're right, the CGI work there, didn't look as fantastic as it has done in some of their other stuff. But it maybe they were working with what they could get. And it felt, I mean, it's probably the locale that did it. It reminded me a lot of Mission Impossible then, more than anything else. I was expecting to see Tom Cruise flying out a window alongside them and then grabbing onto a rope and swinging back in again.
I think the problem, just to focus on that one scene unfairly for a moment, is the fact that there's no genuine motivation in it. They break into this apartment, into this penthouse apartment, to collect something from the underneath of the car, which is already a bit of a leap in the narrative. Mm-hmm. And then he drives the car out of... They get stuck. The shutters begin going down. The alarm's triggered. And they drive... What's their plan? There's never any plan. I never felt there was any genuine sense of momentum because nothing really made any sense.
Step one was get out of the vault before we get stuck. And then step two was, oh no, Jason Statham has appeared out of thin air again. At that point, there's no more plot.
They seem to have no problem with...
in the room.
So they're actually... I mean, the plot of this film is them searching for a device will help them hunt the man who's on their very doorstep all the time.
Yeah, permanently in the room next door. It's brilliant.
But they do say they do what they do best, which is improvise. And some of the action scenes did feel a little bit improvised, but... they were fun. They were good scenes to watch. You know, they may have been CG, but I enjoyed those scenes of the flying cars going from building to building.
Does the ensemble still work? Because obviously one of the great things that is accidental, rather because it's not focus group, it is serendipity. It has such a multiracial cast. It has such a diverse cast from Vin Diesel. Well, Paul Walker was really the only Caucasian male in the films. Are they as together in this film? I mean, obviously, they've had a problem by losing one of their leads, but does Vin Diesel...
It still works to some extent. I do think the constantly going about family for the seventh film in a row and some of the plot and the emotional beats they're going to get is getting a little bit tiring, but it just about works on here because when you realise it's not so much the characters, it is almost in a postmodern way about the actors. It's impossible to go into this film without thinking about Paul Walker and his untimely death while they were filming it. But for all of that, they did a very good job. They were very respectful. I thought the ending was really well done, and you can see the love, at least between, you know, the characters of the actors through the characters. So it kind of works, and it does carry it through. Whether it would work with, you know, different actors, and apparently there's going to be three more films being greenlit already. How it's going to work through those, I have no idea. But
is Vin Diesel strong enough to carry the franchise on his own considerably broad shoulders?
He hasn't been strong enough to carry it since, you know, the fourth film, which fortunately, as long as The Rock keeps staying in and teaming up with Vin Diesel and the pair of them, I would happily watch another 30 films, never mind another three.
Mark, self-awareness, again, I sort of got into a discussion on Twitter after I saw it about the amount of ogling this film does of female bottoms and the female form. We have a new character, this British computer hacker they have to find, and when they do find her, the first thing they do is put her in a swimsuit scene. That feels very retrograde to me. I feel that film, that this self-aware shouldn't be making mistakes that we chastise Michael Bay for. Is it trying to be too... It looks like it's progressive because of this cast, but in the end it's making the same silly, vaguely sexist mistakes that cinema's been, these sort of films have been making for years.
I think it's the things that the series have been doing for years, and I think you have to either accept the series is going to do that and you know, just move on, or, you know, I don't think the series will ever change in that sense. When you go back to the original Fast and Furious in 2001, it was effectively a movie for fetishists of cars and women in bikinis.
I think it is part of the DNA of the films, so from the car culture which it started off, which is great-looking girls and great-looking cars, and putting two and two together.
But how does that sit with having? Because, but the, it has to. It's that's not an excuse any longer. It's how can we if we're applauding the film for its advance on the action scenes and becoming something else there? Why couldn't it become something else on this level? It's got Michelle Rodriguez playing Michelle Rodriguez, but she's a proactive, strong female character. The hacker, when she's not parading around in beachwear and being ogled by the men who decide she's worthy of joining the team because she looks good in beachwear, is capable of doing something. Why can't it it I think it's with a cast that is Hispanic and African American and all, you know, Arab and Japanese. I think it needs to make that next step.
It is a reflection on the culture that they have always been selling to, which is, you know, that fast culture.
But they're not just selling to that culture.
But here, they do, you know, you're saying about the characters judge her and say, yeah, she can join us, she, you know, she looks good in bikini. But they are innocently put down, they are judged by the other characters saying this is not acceptable. So they are actually putting the message out there.
I don't think it makes that...
I don't know, you can accuse it of having its cake and eating it, but it does make those points. This series has also had a number of strong women from Gina Carino in the last film, and Wanda Rousey in this film.
You've always had this weird dichotomy of the series of having two or three strong female characters in the centre, and I think it's talk about bringing Eva Mendes, who was in one of the earlier installments, back for the next one to try and sort of boost that roster. And then there's the extensive window dressing in the background of people wandering past. I mean, it goes almost beyond the point of parody in this one, that you really can't go 10 seconds without a woman wandering past and the camera is at waist level.
But should it be getting more criticism for that? Because, again, we've just had... is there a double standard here? Other films get picked up on this. This film was... I read perfectly respectable movie bloggers almost jokingly saying, well, it's obviously sponsored by by this stuff.
I wouldn't go as far as to defend it, but at the same time, I do think it feels almost as if James Wan has done it out of a sense of obligation more than actually a feeling of anything artistic. You know, it's just done so much so repeatedly and almost so disinterestedly. You know, the camera is not... almost ogling the female form. It's just women just keep wandering past, almost to the point of it feels like it's going to turn to Monty Python sketch. It's bizarre in that sense. I don't really think it's actually achieving anything or doing anything more or less than the other films have done in that sense, because they've all suffered from the same issues. It's maybe you see a little bit more, it's more repetitive in the film in this sense, but I don't think... in that sense, it's any better or worse than the other six films have been.
I think the reason I'm so strident on this is this is the first one of these films I've seen at the cinema, and it's only the second I've seen all the way through. I've seen number five, but I haven't seen, and I've seen half of two, I think. I find them very poorly directed. Sorry, I find them extraordinarily dull. I was surprised that it was so repetitive in this imagery.
It does feel that it's become a director for hire series, because James Wan, who's most famous for the Saw films he's been involved with, has sort of been dropped in to do this one. I think probably the success was of Justin Lin, who directed, I think, 3 to 6, and
They were going to get Justin Lin, but I was reading about it, and it's all about scheduling. They were trying to move it up, and they wouldn't have had time.
Is there
as
the Fast and the Furious virgin, is there a marked difference between how James Wan, who, as you pointed out, is the director of The Conjuring and the first two Saw films, I think, and Justin Lin, who's gone off to do Star Trek, is there a marked difference in their directing styles?
Not that I could tell, to be honest.
So it's a house,
style carries over. Mm-hmm. James Wan is a very good director, but he was a director for hire for this. So the reason they couldn't get Justin Lin is because he was supposed to be finishing off when this was supposed to be filmed. And it was only then this got put back an extra year because of Paul Walker's death, where he probably could have done it after
It was supposed to be out last summer.
But by that point...
Yeah. I mean, you look at the action sequences, they are very rote. If you compare it to something like the Bond series, where actually they've gone down the route of getting someone like Sam Mendes in, getting better cinematographers, they've tried to differentiate rather than actually trying to be generic. This is trying to be as generic as possible. This is trying to be...
This is going up the next rung. It's going up the rung to where Bond was. Bond has gone up the rung to where Christopher Nolan's working at. And
I wouldn't be surprised to see a Timothy Dalton or Roger Moore dropping it as an English spy if they come back to London in the next one. It's gone to that point of 70s parody of Bond. I mean, it's a bit unfair to Timothy Dalton because he was in much better Bond films in the 80s, but...
Well, it has to have Burt Reynolds in it, surely. It has to go down the Smokey and the Bandit route if they're bringing... Because they've got Kurt Russell in this, who was in Used Cars.
It is the concept each time, and I think it's kept going and reinvigorated itself because it's tried to find a new concept with each film. So, yeah, you've had the Ocean's 11-type movie, you've had the sort of Mission Impossible-type film, you've had... This is effectively a Bond film, to all intents and purposes. It was as close as the series ever likely to get. You've had the original films. I think it will continue to... If it continues to try and reinvent itself within its very strict framework, it will probably continue to rake in money at the box office.
No reason why it can't. Yeah, that's a fact. I've thought whilst watching it, and this is not a comment on the quality, but I thought it reminded me of the Carry On films. In the fact, it's just like you're watching for the cast. Mm. You can drop them into any environment and you've got that cast. You're going to watch for Dwayne Dwayne Johnson of The Rock.
It could be the cast, but I'm saying one thing you don't watch these films for is a character. It's not like James Bond. It's not like he reinvents and has the same character. The characters here could be anyone, to be honest. It is all about the fast cars, the actions, the stunts, the fights, and they've currently got some of the best people who can do that at the moment in Vin Diesel, The Rock and Jason Statham.
I mean, they change sides and loyalties with such regularity, you'd be surprised if Jason Statham wasn't on their side by about film 9.
To be honest, after enjoying it, I still don't know whether technically they're even the bad guys or the good guys in this film. It's just suddenly all grey.
They suddenly seem to be very happy working with the government, which seems very odd. But anyway, okay, well, Fast and the Furious 7 opened last Friday and is screening at both the Cambridge View and Light Cinemas. It is a certificate PG. After making films such as Greenberg and The Squid and the Whale that depicted the bitter drift of middle age, director Noah Baumbach changed tack with 2013's Francis Ha, which warned of the dangerously slippery slope of youth. Now, with his latest film, While We're Young, Baumbach crashes these two easily panicked worlds together. While We're Young stars Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts as Joss and Cornelia, a married couple who believe that their life, which is unburdened by children and regular 9-to-5 jobs, is still in touch with a youthful spontaneity. This notion is thrown into sharp relief when they meet Jamie and Darby, Adam Driver, and Amanda Seyfried, two bouncing millennials who live a life of loose-limbed boho chic. They're urban adventurers. At the drop of a hat, they keep chickens in the living room, and they dare to wear shoes with no socks.
We met this interesting couple.
What's the rumpus, Rednecks?
I like how engaged they are in everything.
It's like their apartment is full of everything we once threw out, but it looks so good the way they have it.
I've learned along the way you can discover more by allowing yourself to be surprised by what you encounter.
What kind of class is this again?
Hip-hop.
And true gangster don't speak, no love for the police. Everybody knows I'm dope and I'm riding the beat.
We're worried about you guys.
What's with the hat?
What?
You're an old man with a hat.
For the first time in my life, I stopped thinking of myself as a child imitating an adult.
You feel that way too?
Someone knocking at the door. Somebody ringing the bell.
Josh, your sleeve is on fire.
Are you okay, son?
Do me a favor. Open the door. Woo! Ow!
Ow! You have arthritis in your knee.
Arthritis? Arthritis?
Yes. I usually just say it once.
Open the door. And let him in.
Mark, Noah Baumbach has made vital films on both Generation X and Generation Y, but how does he fare bringing the two generations together?
I think it works to an extent. I've enjoyed some of his early films more than I did this one. There were just a few moments in this to me which just felt slightly false. I've seen a lot of reviews which described it as being a sort of better Woody Allen movie than Woody Allen's made in recent years. And I suppose, yeah, as you're getting into the Generation X side of it, in terms of Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts' characters, you know, it almost does feel as that sort of world-weary, sly witticism approach that sort of seems to be coming in, and probably slightly more overtly than in films like Greenberg or Francis Ha that we've seen previously. I don't know it necessarily quite gels. It never quite felt to me... In sense of sort of believability in terms of them getting together with Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried's characters, and a few of the set pieces, like when they go to a retreat and they're all taking, you know, psychotropic drugs and vomiting into buckets and things like that. Again, it felt slightly too stagey. I think it has got a lot of good things to say about character, and it did appeal to me on a certain level as someone who's entered his 40s and at risk of a midlife crisis at the drop of a hat.
Small hat.
Yes, absolutely.
Too small for your head.
There is no hat which isn't too small for my head, sadly. You can't get this on radio, but I have a massive head and I just can't get hats to fit. So I have that. I don't know what it is. It doesn't look like a big head.
Do I look like an agony uncle?
If anyone that can find big hats for me, this is a Cambridge-wide appeal for a big hat for me. I just need something to help me sartorially. We've got slightly off track now. I can't even remember what I was talking about. It's a good film, but with flaws.
Faye, some critics... Have said that this film is too cruel on Generation Y, on Adam Driver's character especially. Did you find that was the case? Because I think the director's aiming for a broad brush across both generations, but he seems to be picking more on Y.
Yeah, I completely understand where critics are coming from on that. I think it's like a lot of his work, like Noah Baumbach's work, it is always quite personal, and I don't see it necessarily as kind of like a not an attack on Generation Y. I can see they've really stereotyped them very heavily, like thick rimmed glasses, Brooklyn house shares, you know, the lot. But in a way, I think it's kind of like a personal nod to Generation Y, and actually that he's kind of subtly highlighted the positive side to Generation Y versus sort of Generation X. But I do see where critics are coming from on that one, and I do agree with them to some extent. But I think there is also the other side to the argument, where actually I do feel that it is a bit of a compliment to Generation Y, as well as I think you really stereotyped heavily on them. So
is it too broad? Because it's a weird film, and then it falls between two stools in a way that it's been screening at the multiplex cinemas, who might be expecting a Ben Stiller comedy along the lines of Here Comes Polly or something of that, but it's not that, but it's a quite broad for a Noah Baumbach film, really.
Yeah, and that's, I think, something that I didn't struggle with, but I did feel, I wasn't sure what I went in, you know, I wasn't sure what I was expecting when I went in, but I kind of felt it was caught in the crossfire of this wonderful sort of Baumbach indie, very personal kind of, but then it had sort of Naomi Watts, Ben Stiller, and it kind of then had a bit of a real commercial stamp, and I think that kind of weighed it down a little bit. It does show through a lot. I kind of went in expecting a more serious, more down-to-earth, this is 40 type situation, you know, when they reach their 40s and then they have a bit of a breakdown, then they try and turn the clocks back. But it wasn't. It was a kind of...
It's more constructive than that, really.
Yeah, yeah.
In the end, that's why he's bringing these two that's why he's bringing the millennials and Generation X together, is thinking, well, actually, we can help each other. In a sort
I
of,
do agree
I'm,
with
I'm simplifying
piece.
It there, but...
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the challenge of you're going to have to take the perspective of either one side or the other if you're coming from this, and Noah Baumbach is coming from the Generation X perspective. And I think there's a certain sense of wistfulness, of actually a bit of jealousy of looking at what the new generation are bringing, almost that slight romanticism of actually being able to put away things like technology, getting out the typewriters and, you know, not being afraid to do that. And actually it sort of encompasses the certain nervousness there is about still wanting to try and hang on desperately to, you know, what we used to do in our 20s, but... Actually, you know, how feasible is that anymore? How feasible it is to go to late night parties and try and be hip and trendy? And actually, you know, they see a route into that world through Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried's characters. I think there is almost a sense of feeling of loss and a feeling of almost exasperation. They can't quite get into that world. So
it's not a feeling of loss so much as a feeling of not appreciating these things. Hence the conversation the brief conversation about the Goonies, where Adam Horowitz's character, who plays the father they know, Ad-Rock from Beastie Boys, brilliant little performance, when he says, since when has the Goonies become good? And because they don't seem to appreciated these things and they grew up with them, so they're grabbing onto them in panic because Generation Y, the millennials, are grabbing onto them non-ironically. I found that was other than some of the jokes, Simon, that was the bit that landed with me. I found the most interesting. I kept finding it shone light on little interesting bits like that, the idea of the difference between sharing and stealing. And I thought about you with this because of, you won't remember, but no, because of your opinion of The Imposter, the documentary, which you thought crossed ethical lines at the time, and I agreed with you. It raises that question, I felt, which I thought, did it go enough?
Does. I kind of find this film tried almost have too much going for it. I really enjoyed most of the film, and I enjoyed all the Gen X, Gen Y counterculture thing, especially how they had the hipsters being completely anti-technology, which was more like how the Gen X got brought up. You know, we lived it the first time round without technology, and then it kind of reversed, and it did give you an extra sense of nostalgia to what it was like, and the almost like the false nostalgia that the Gen Y Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried bring to it. But then there was the actual plot as well that they try to put into the storyline about the documentaries they're writing, which felt like, I thought, could have been another different film entirely, especially towards the end where they are talking about authenticity in documentaries, which to one point I thought was quite interesting, but by the end of it I just thought it seemed tacked on to the film. And
no, and I like the way that it ended up that Adam Driver's character, who's probably a little bit too much of a bad guy in this film, but the way his ethics are not so far off base to Charles Grodin's character, who's the baby boomer documentarian.
That is probably one of the best scenes in the film, which, to be honest, I do not want to discuss here, and I don't want to say anything about it because of the surprise and the twist, and I think it was a big turning point in the entire film.
It is a good scene, yes.
And it's a fantastic scene, and if you've seen it, you probably know what I'm talking about, but I'm not really going to go on here. But apart from that, I think they just try to push it too far on that point and introduce too much plot, which then overruled the rest of the film's commentary about the, you know, Gen X v Gen Y collision.
Okay, all right, we're going to wrap it up there so we have more time left for Force Majeure at the end. While We're Young opened last week and is still screening the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Over the next couple of months, the Cambridge Arts Picture House is offering a rare chance to see the work of Czechoslovakian director Vera Hetilova, including her hugely influential second film, Daisies, and its 1968 follow-up, The Fruits of Paradise. Though she made movies for almost 50 years, Vera Hetilova's career bloomed during the period of the 1960s Prague Spring. Daisies, which opens the Picture House season on Sunday, the 19th of April, remains her most famous work, a new wave masterpiece about two teenage girls who snub their noses at Czech society and throw themselves into gluttony and tomfoolery. Released in 1966 or 67, because it was banned in Czechoslovakia for a year, it remains a staggeringly innovative piece of cinema. To get a better idea of Vera Hetilova's work, I talked to Maheli Modi, founder of Second Run DVD, a boutique label specialising in rarities of world cinema, including Daisies. We spoke about the role of feminism in Hetilova's work and whether Daisies shocked audiences when it was first released. But I began by asking if it was a difficulty in actually seeing the work of a director like Vera Hetilova that led to him starting the Second Run label.
That's exactly the reason why I started Second Run, because there were so many films that I wanted to see which I couldn't find anywhere on DVD or video. And so at that time I thought, well, is there a way to make this work? You know, it's always going to be niche and it's never going to be something where you've got a big office and drive big cars or anything, but if there's just enough to do it and continue doing it, then it would be worth trying. You know, it's something like Daisies, which was her first film that we released, but it took like 5 years before it seeped into kind of people's consciousness. I remember the first screenings we had, I was literally standing outside the cinema saying, you know, come to see this film. And then it just gradually built and built and people wrote about it, and it just takes that long. And the film is, you know, it's quite... it's a very avant-garde work, but the audience perfectly in tune and reacted to it.
To stay with Daisies, and pick up on what you said there, having watched it again in the last couple of weeks, the portrayal of our two leading women, their disregard of men, the gluttony, the willful destruction, simply the number of scenes that are set in and around toilets. How shocking would that have been even outside the mainstream?
Depends whether if we're talking about Daisies escaping and being seen in the West or Daisies being seen within Czechoslovakia. There was a climate there at the time which had to do with form and aesthetics rather than narrative. You know, art cinema was very appreciated. I mean, one of your things you've asked is about what would have been her influences. I don't know, but I do know that she ran like the film clubs at the film school, and she was responsible for bringing, you know, what we call art films from around the world for people there to see. So it wasn't just the art aspect of it or the hidden messages of it. It was also the fact that the audience in Czechoslovakia at the time were receptive two things which were outside the mainstream. In a sense, much more so than we are here now. So her work did get around quite a lot, and she was very influential within a group of filmmakers.
Again, sitting through it, and it would be possibly fair to say that the politics are very much of their time, as you've said, and it's very Czech in its focus, but that the film still feels pertinent because of her sort of active interaction filmmaking, which leaves things as open-ended as possible for audience interpretation. Is that something that gives the film so much more life today?
Yes, it does. She said that they didn't allow us themselves, and when I say themselves, it's not just her, but a key part of her filmmaking, and certainly of Daisies and then Fruit of Paradise, is the cameraman Yaroslav Kuchera and the writer and designer called Esther Chrumbakova. So what they wanted to do, or what Chytilova said, was that they wanted to be bound by nothing. No, literally nothing. And then they thought that given that freedom to be bound by nothing, they should allow the film to be open to many interpretations. And just as she demanded absolute freedom as a creator, the same privilege needed to be granted to the audience.
As you mentioned, the designer-writer, she also worked on Valerie and Her Week of Wonders, which has a similar approach to its female protagonists. Chytilova seems to suggest in other interviews that she's not fond of being stereotyped as feminist, but it's there. But do you think it comes as much from the writer and the designer, that approach, rather than her own approach?
They were very, they were very suspicious of the slogans the West used and aligning themselves with those slogans. And I think this thing about her work being feminist is one of those slogans. And she didn't like that. She thought it was individualism, not feminism. And there is an interpretation which also says that their freedom is being used to do things that aren't really important.
Oh, yes, yes. The punk and nihilist is remarkable now.
Yes. You know, and like even with the ending when they say, okay, we'll be good now, and they start tidying up everywhere, etc. It's open to so many kind of interpretations, just depending on where your mind is at that time. And I think that's one of the reasons why people do react to it.
Ani to mi nejde. Tak co nám jde? Nic nám nejde. Co děláš? Já jsem pana. Aha.
So how does it stand in her own body of work? Did she ever get this experimental again in terms of form?
Completely. In fact, she had one film in progress at that time, which was Fruit of Paradise, which was made in 1969. And that, you know, was released. It's the same three people, Chrumbakova, Chytilova, and Kuchera. And it's formally an absolutely beautiful film. And then after 69, she could not work again. They just wouldn't give her the funding or a script or approval. And then from 76 onwards, every 3 or 4 years she managed to make a film which, you know, continued to remain critical of the system. Now they're beginning to upgrade her work, and they've noticed that wherever they send Daisies, people go to see it now. And I hope in time people will see Fruit of Paradise too, because that's a very, very special film. It really is the most formally beautiful film. And the soundtrack. And, you know, there's just, those were like artists all working. How do you say it? You know, I think I wrote on the notes at the back that they're kind of, it was a group of artists working at the peak of their powers. So Fruit of Paradise, if you can see it on the big screen, you must. And that's where all these films should be seen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many, many thanks to Mehli Modi for squeezing the interview in during a very busy week at Second Run, and to Chris Barwick of Second Run for arranging, and special thanks to Daniel Fawcett from the Portugal-based Underground Film Studios, who very kindly forwarded me some difficult-to-find notes on Vera Hetilova's early films. The Vera Hetilova season starts at the Arts Picture House on Sunday the 19th of April with a 6pm screening of Daisies, and screens a film every following Sunday, finishing on the 24th of May with Traps, which is one of her few post-communist era films. As always, you can find out more details both at the Arts Picture House, or you can check pages 22 and 23 of the new brochure, which rather wonderfully has an image of Daisies on the front.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1pm with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
And Bookmark follows on right after we're done at 1pm. On the Pro on Their programme today, they've got poet and spoken word artist Holly McNeish, political thriller writer Misha Hiller, and Robin Stevens, who is the author of the Wells and Wong Mysteries for Children. Following on from Bookmark at 2pm is Best of the Guests, another chance to hear some of the best interviews from the past week on Cambridge 105. Then at 3pm, it's Italians in Cambridge with Radio Dante. But at the moment, you are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105. I'm Toby Miller, and with me in the studio today are Faye Gentile, Simon West, Dave Riley and Mark Livis. It's still to come as our review of Swedish drama Force Majeure, but before that, we've got to enact some revenge.
I lost everything. That dog was a final gift from my dying wife.
Jonathan, you got out once. You dip so much as a pinky back into this pond, you may find something reaching out to pull you back in.
It's personal.
Where'd you get that car?
What does it matter?
It's not what you did, son. It's who you did it to.
The nobody?
That nobody. It's John Wick.
You working again?
No, just sorting some stuff out.
Task your crew.
How many?
As many as you have.
Every so often, the action genre needs a shot in the arm. Out with the scratchy fist fights and the slow coach car chases, and in with the new blood. Heavily influenced by the clean lines and dance-like pose of anime and Indonesian cinema, new release John Wick hopes to be just such a tonic. The plot of John Wick is brutal in its simplicity. Played by Keanu Reeves, it is most laconic. Wick is an ex-assassin, aroused, and Russian hoodlums break into his home, steal his car, and kill his dog. The puppy was a parting gift from his just-buried wife, and in the blink of an eye, Wick is slick. Back his hair, shrugged on his best suit, and loaded his many, many guns. He is after the men who robbed him, and he will rain hell and a hail of bullets onto anyone fool enough to try to stop him. Dave, John Wick has taken an age to reach the UK cinemas after its 2014 release in America, about 6 months. Worth the wait, do you think?
Oh, yes, very much so. And it was an even longer wait for me because I didn't get to see it until the very small hours of this morning. So, but I was hooked the entire time. I only realised that I really needed to get some sleep when I finally left the cinema and suddenly realised, oh, the world is a terrible place, but Keanu Reeves will save me. It was awesome.
He'll kill you if you get in his way.
No, I'm the good guy.
I don't think he differentiates like that. Simon, for all the hype about the action, is it the action that raises us above being just a normal sort of Death Wish taken clone?
I don't think
clone?
It is. No, it's got this nice, dark sense of humour to it. It sounds like when you read out any other revenge action flick, which we've seen many, and, you know, Jason Statham, as we mentioned, has been in many, lots of them. But I was wondering, why has it got such a great word of mouth? What has actually elevated it? And I think they have, despite a simple plot, they have introduced a backstory, an entire world built around the hitmen having
not quite their own union as they'd wanted in Gross Point Blank, but their own. But you know, they've got their own hotel and safe grounds and language, and there's you realise you're just seeing a glimpse of the entire back infrastructure and everything else that works around it. And I think it's those moments, the moments of recognition between two assassins, which normally make people laugh in the cinema, which raises it above just another action.
So we're talking about mythology again.
It's an entire modern mythology, but it only gives you the glimpses of it, which is just an absolutely wonderful touch, because it doesn't take away from the fact that the action scenes are absolutely phenomenal. The choreographies, the stunt work. It's apparently directed by a stunt double from The Matrix, and
yes, they've been stunt coordinators for a very long time.
Together for a long time, and it was that magic which I think it just given it that sleeper hit, the sleeper hit feel to it, which I'm surprised it took 6 months, because I don't think they expected it to be this popular. But it is that combination of the action plus that knowing mythology which raises it above any other revenge thriller. I mean, I saw Dave when I came out of my showing, and I was very, very tempted to just turn straight round and go watch it a second time.
Should it have been, Dave, should it have been, as Simon's mentioned, the world building is wonderful. It's great fun. You could imagine a TV series, which is probably how it ended up, a tea time cartoon set in the halls of the hotel for serial killers. But RoboCop was a tea time cartoon. Everything eventually becomes a tea time cartoon. But is it too self-aware about that? And should it have spent a little bit more time sort of actually having a little bit more of a plot rather than just simply this linear computer game progress that John Wick takes, beating boss after boss after boss?
It's a tricky one to decide. I mean, I actually found the lack of a plot kind of quite refreshing. He's got this one singular purpose and drive throughout the film. I mean, it starts off, you know, really quite quietly. It's a series of intercut flashbacks, really nicely done, about what's happened to his wife. And then when his puppy arrives, she's given him the puppy as a final gift so that he doesn't have to go through the mourning process alone. And then it's something ridiculous, like 2 days later, everything goes wrong. And all he's got left to hold on to at that point is his anger, because he's never dispelled it. And it kept that in mind, and it's like, you don't need a plot when you've just got a really angry man going.
But then perhaps it should have become, because I was sort of hoping, I enjoyed this, but I was sort of and the action scenes are great fun, and the universe buildings is very
brilliant,
pleasing,
yeah.
But I was hoping for something a little bit cooler and sharper, like a Lee Marvin film, or like Point Blank. It just felt a little bit too full of itself.
You've got the original cool breeze in the casting role.
There's just something very, very satisfying about watching somebody who's the best at what he does, doing what he does very, very well. And that is what you get in this film. It doesn't need a plot. You're watching some of the best people. And I don't necessarily mean John Wick killing people. It's also, you know, Keanu Reeves doing his, you know, cool action film. I noticed on Twitter that the only thing you really completed... one of the things to complain about is the soundtrack.
Which I forgot about that, yes.
I quite liked the soundtrack, and it wasn't quite cool enough, but I don't know what
I
think possibly it's one of the things where it was a lot of the magic was there, but it wasn't all there, and it wasn't plotted down to be, this is going to be the next cool film, we're going to, you know, because it wasn't marketed, it hasn't planned out. I think
it operates
that
like
they made this film.
I think
and
it's aiming.
So much
no, I think it's
I
aiming.
Think
I think
aim
it's
for.
Aiming for a coolness. It doesn't. I like Keanu Reeves very much. I like him in this role, and I'm glad he's getting his due finally. But when you slow down shots in the way this film is slowing down shots, then you're aiming for a pre-programmed cool, and I find that cynical and I find it tiresome. The reason I mentioned the music, which I had forgotten about, thank you for reminding me. I'd been angry.
Oh dear.
It's garbage. Not the music itself, which is not my taste, but the fact that it's slathered over the action scenes and it buries the audio of the action scenes. And it turns them into these They've got these wonderful fights which are brilliantly choreographed and intelligently shot, and they're ruined by, one, the editing, which is fairly generic, and two, the music, which takes away all the crunch and bite from them. That is the one bit that turns it into a normal Jason Statham film,
Shoot most people in the fights.
Yeah, I do.
Pretty nice. I was thinking especially with the fight that he has in the hotel room with the female assassin, Perkins, which is, you can't hear anything that's going on because of the score, which just made me think I was sitting in a computer game.
Maybe they cranked up the speed. I know we went to different showings, but I could hear everything perfectly well in mine.
I would have wanted as much invention in that area.
You wanted the Jason Bourne crunches without any soundtrack.
I
liked the soundtrack. I thought Tyler Bates and Marilyn Manson did a very good job together.
I just want a little bit more of invention there to go with the invention everywhere else. But maybe that would have been. Maybe it would.
I wanted more Lovejoy. We don't always get what. We
Ian McShane's in it very little.
I know.
Very little. I don't think he would be pleased to still be known as Lovejoy after all these years.
I can't help it.
He's no longer shunts his jacket
That's how
sleeves
I met
up his
him.
Arm. All right. Okay. All right. Well, John Wick opened yesterday, Friday, April the 10th, and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a Certificate 15. Winner of the Ensemble Regard Prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival, new drama Force Majeure is the fourth film from well-respected Swedish writer-director Ruben Östlund. Set in the high season in a luxurious ski resort in the French Alps, the film focuses its keen gaze on what seems to be the perfect family, farmer Father Thomas, wife Eva, and their two children, Vera and Harry. Everything is rosy until the al fresco dinner under the mountain is interrupted by a controlled avalanche which looks to tumble off its intended path. As the snow barrels towards them, Thomas flees in blind panic, leaving his family behind to fend for themselves. When the dust clears, the wall of white turns out to have been merely a rush of snow fog, Thomas's sudden act of cowardice and desertion has set off its own chain reaction. Mark, in this era of sloppy cinema, it's rare to find something as clinical as Force Majeure. In some respects, it feels a bit like early Polanski. Did you find the film Mind fascinating territory with its look at the male ego?
Absolutely. Some of the other comparisons I've seen as well are to the likes of Haneker. It's been compared to the likes of Hidden, which was one of my favourite films of the last decade.
It has more humour than Haneker usually has, but
it,
yes.
It does. And I think it's, you know, some of Haneker's films, apart from things like The White Ribbon, could be very cold and clinical. And actually, this is very darkly humorous. I think there's a certain amount of warmth here as well, but it's doing a lot to explore actually how that warmth can be a facade, how it can be, you know, quite fake and misplaced. It really does a huge amount to get underneath some of these familial relationships that we have, and actually how some of those. The film starts with a family photograph of the four of them being almost forced into being huddled together, and then spends the next 2 hours very cleverly breaking down that set of relationships and looking at all the relationships in the family, looking at relationships with some of the other supporting characters as well. And it just has a huge amount to say in a short space of time about human nature. And it's shot in just a beautiful, crisp, stark style. You know, the setting, the bleakness, the sort of, you know, almost ever-present threat of the weather as well just helps add to the feeling of tension that's sat throughout the film. It's brilliant.
Faye, it makes you wonder, this film made me wonder why all films aren't set on ski resorts. It's such a rich avenue, rich territory for metaphor, and Östlund keeps finding different ways of visually representing his family falling apart. How did you like the eventual culmination of these experiences?
Absolutely agree. And to go on, you know, your point as well, it was beautifully shot. I can't say enough about the cinematography. It was, and I think that combined with it being filmed on a ski resort, it was a very quiet film, and it was a big metaphor. I think the ski resort itself and the snow and everything was this, and the fog was a massive.
These constant metaphor. Explosions of destinations in the mountains.
It was. I mean, on reflection, I mean, at the time, as I said earlier, I found it very uncomfortable to watch, and that's because probably the beautiful cinematography, the silence, and the awkwardness posed by the characters and the relationships that are building, and kind of the way it was explored. But yeah, it was. It was. It didn't hit me at first, and, you know, as an average viewer, but it did sort of towards the middle and the end of the film. I thought, wow, this holiday isn't the holiday, it's the story, it's the metaphor within. But yeah, no, it was very good.
Does it work when, as you wind it, because obviously we first deal with the cowardice and the, not just so much the cowardice as the inability to notice he's been coward or to apologise for being a coward that Thomas has. When the film widens this out a little bit, to take in his best friend and the crumbling of his relationship with his 20-year-old, and then this awful-looking sauna party that our hero gets reluctantly dragged too briefly. Does it when it's widening out its look at men, does it succeed or does it lose focus a little?
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it does shine a pretty stark and awful light on men's behaviour, but I think it wasn't really about him running away from the table and leaving his family. It was actually about the relationship that was breaking down within the marriage, and also, you know, with, as the counterpart, the best friend and the couple, that's a 20-year-old girlfriend. It was more about actually how the situation is dealt with, him opening up to his actions and how he behaves with his family. So yeah, absolutely, it opened up this whole Pandora's box, if you will, of mess in the relationship. Yeah,
I think, Mark, I found it absolutely riveting, and I found it kind of depressing, because I noticed little aspects of my own behaviour in the past. I'm not ever run away from a family in an avalanche or attended a sauna party.
You haven't lived, frankly.
Haven't lived, no. But it's a sort of interesting companion piece to Fight Club, in many ways, I felt, in its depiction of men, egos, and the fragility, the tiniest things which can lock them down and the tiniest things which can pick them up.
It does, and I think it excels is actually watching the reflection of that in the wife character and the effect that these succession of events is actually having on her. And you see there's one scene where she's chatting to a friend, and the friend is basically living the life of Riley. She's having a variety of relationships and she's having everything she wants, and the wife is living through a sense of familial obligation, and sort of thinking, well, why am I? Because I'm getting nothing back out of this at all. You know, and actually she's the sort of prism through which you see all these male inadequacies just coming to the fore. And it's almost heartbreaking in that sense of you know, you see that, feel that sense of obligation in society, and you know, it's just brilliant the way it breaks it down, and I can't say enough good things about it.
I like the scene in with the friend and his face hit, his 20-year-old lover, where he's just lying there and says, I can't believe how you would think this of me. And he's taking this tiny little thing and it's this crampon and using it to just deliberately make this crack so he can feel bad. And then there's an extraordinary scene where Thomas just balls his eyes out and turns the entire thing into his prop, into he's the victim here, which is just depressing as hell because it's what men do.
that sense, he's almost trying to feel bad for what he's done, but he's
trying to cleanse himself, but in a way that that managed to make him still a man. When, yes. You know, or his depiction of how he feels he should be.
To be a true man, he can't have that guilt. That's not part of the
psyche. Well, if he has to, turn it into something else. It has to be something theatrical. Mm. If you're going to cry, you've really got to cry. And his wife's reluctance to join in on this party that the children want to be part of, and we haven't mentioned the children, they're quite quite brilliant in this, the family life. I thought that was very, very sharp. I thought that was... I don't usually see that sort of... As I said at the beginning, clinical sharpness in modern filmmaking, really. But no, absolutely fascinating, quite wonderful. Force Majeure opened yesterday and is currently screening at the Arts Picture House. What certificate is it? I saw it on Curzon online, so I don't know. Sorry, anybody know? Faye, you saw it at the cinema.
I did, yeah.
It would be a 15, I would imagine, for language.
I'd say it was a 15, yeah.
I would say so. All right, we've guessed it a 15.
I can't think how many 12-year-olds are going to be rushing to see it.
No. Who knows? There's a toy line. That's it for this week, I'm afraid. The last hour extended a little bit with some more interview with Vera Hitalova. Vera Hitalova will be our Cambridge 105 podcast in a couple of days. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter and iTunes. Simply search for Bums on Seats. We will be back on April the 25th in 2 weeks, which will be mainly Age of Ultron, I would have thought, the Avengers sequel. There will also be The Fallen, which is a sort of naughty gothic drama set in 1960s. Britain and Alan Rickman's A Little Chaos, which uses the too often forgotten drama of gardening to bring life to the 15th century romance. See, I'm looking forward to that more than the Avengers. Unless the Avengers has gardening in it. From everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.